Welcome to Paradigm Shifters. We have a wonderful paradigm shifter. I always say that because those are the people I like talking to. But today we're going to speak to Reverend Bill McDonald. And Bill is a spiritual warrior. I'm telling you, this guy really is that. And he's been through so many phases of activating his own spiritual presence through a rather difficult life, through the Vietnam War, through teaching people all over the place, and you've got a whole other book coming up. Let's hear from you about all this, Bill. How are you tonight?
Well, actually, I'm happy to be in the now, which is where I always enjoy being best, in the present moment. But what's interesting is I've already, this is 22nd of the month or the 25th or whatever day it is, and I've had like 6 interviews on the radio this year, and every single one of them, I was looking forward to yours, because every single interview was on a subject matter that wasn't really something I wanted to talk about. I've been called up to talk about politics, Muslims, Christianity, the Bible, PTSD, disabled veterans, homeless veterans. I mean, a lot of issues I'm going, doesn't anybody want to hear about the esoteric, mystical things in life? Does anybody want to hear about why we're here? What's the purpose? You know? So I'm looking forward to this conversation with you guys. I think you're a like person here. I can feel the vibration here. We're going to do all right. I think we're on the same wavelength.
Yeah, we're going to have some fun with it, too. So it's really interesting because with your preamble there and also knowing your, I know you're in the now, but your now is very much a product of the wisdom that you've accrued through many, many experiences. So we're going to pick at some of those, right? So if we're in the spiritual mode and in the now and so on, why? I have some theories, spiritual attitudes to this as well, but I'd love your perspective on why is it that we as a species are still killing each other? Why are we so violent? Why is it so vicious? Where is evolution? What is the spiritual journey in all this?
Okay, let's get even bigger picture than that.
Okay.
Let's go bigger than that. Let's assume that this Earth cycle, according to the Hindus and the not Hindus in particular, not the yogis, that we're like through five worlds already, five of these civilizations. We're going on the 6th root race the next time. So we're evolving as a species, spiritually, physically, metaphorically, and every other way. It's like, as the Nath Yogi tradition teaches, the Noah's Ark was basically saving the best DNA and changing human beings and changing for spiritual evolution, changing our DNA. So this has been an ongoing process for a lot longer than the Christian religion would like you to believe. You know, they think it's thousands of years. And the Indians and the Tibetans, they're going to tell you this thing is that's a billion-year process or more. This thing's been going on a long time. We've had civilizations come, we've had civilizations go. Well, what happened on Easter Island? What happened before Easter Island? And what happened before the Incas and the Aztecs and before Egypt? And what are these great civilizations that we keep discovering little things, underwater cities and temples out in the middle of the Caribbean and the Mediterranean? So there's a lot of stuff going on out there. You ask the question on why we are evolving. It's just a slow evolutionary process. And people... Well, my theory, we are evolving individualistically and we're evolving as a group. And some groups evolve out and then some groups start. So you're always going to have some people at the bottom starting out fresh into this creation, coming into existence, working their way up through literal evolution through whether people want to believe it or not, but through the minerals, to rocks, to plants, to animals, to eventually to people, and getting an individualized soul. So that's another thought process. There really is an evolution going on. Maybe not like Darwin says, you know, did we actually evolve from monkeys or something, but was the spirit, the soul, the essence of who we are, did that evolve and was put into a fittable body, something that could hold us, contain us? Anyway, so I think things are getting better. At the same time, there's a balance, you know, like yin and yang, light and dark, good and bad. As highly evolved spiritual beings move on, there's a balance in the universe. There's evil people with power that are coming. So this is an ongoing thing. As long as you've got goodness out there, you're going to have evil.
Well, you know something, Bill, I want to take it two ways. I wanted to get personalized here. I want to figure out what was going on inside of you regarding the awareness of your spiritual development, even as a small person, as a young person. And where is it all? I mean, do we have to stay on the physical? Do we have to stay on the earth plane track for many, many multifaceted evolutions of the species, or can we just move on to different tracks? That's two different approaches. So can we talk about you first, okay?
Okay. All right. First off, you're right. There's two different tracks here because it is possible that you can move on in your spiritual evolution, not on this plane or not on this dimension or not on this planet, okay?
Yeah, I like that idea.
All right, so you can evolve. If you read the book Autobiography of the Yogi, and it talks about Paramahansa Yogananda's guru, mm-hmm. Shivateshwar. Mm-hmm. He went on, after he left here, to help evolve souls on this other planet. So you got to, all of a sudden you go, what? Where did this come from, right? There's another group someplace else. So we are not the only intelligent species or soul of God. God is everywhere. And I'm sure in that great cosmos, which is beyond any scope of imagination, there are existences. There are evolutions going on at various levels. So, yeah. All right. So, on a personal
Just wait a sec before we leave that section. Can we choose that, Bill? And do we choose it before we arrive here? Like, where's the consciousness? Where's the intelligence part?
Okay. Let's talk about this whole process because people talk about free will and they overdo it. Mm-hmm. And people talk about we're all one with God, you're already there, you just got to wake up.
Yeah.
But at some point in time, if you're not awakened and you've done the work to awaken and you've gotten to that point, you're not going to be able to dictate to the universe too much because your karma is going to dictate to you what you're going to be doing, who you're going to be meeting, what you're going through, what trials you have, what lessons you have. The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, we need to kind of use our glossary because everybody uses karma in a different, not everybody, but a lot of us use karma in a different way.
Okay.
You're saying it's leftovers.
A tooth for a tooth and a hair for a hair and an eye for an eye and all that good stuff. That's karma. That's a basic form of karma. Whatever action, there's a reaction.
And some of it is good, right?
Oh, karma's karma. Some of it is it's karma. You become president or you win $1 billion. I mean, that could be good karma.
Mm-hmm.
So karma is just stuff, your desires, unfulfilled desires, and debts.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you've been ripping people off, you got this debt when you come back, you're probably going to get ripped off yourself. You've got to repay these people. You've got to make amends. So if you've done good in the world, you come back, you may be having good things happen. It doesn't matter. And sometimes you can't judge karma by what's happening to somebody for health or things because sometimes things happen to you for a purpose other than karma.
Right.
It's to help inspire the group. It's to teach you lessons. I have found, as I traveled around the world.
Well, wait a minute. When you say teach you lessons, sometimes it's to awaken us, isn't it? It's like give yourself a search for power or something.
Everything comes to us for a reason. It's not a random universe, and it's not a random life. Before you came here, for example, let's get down to basics here.
Yeah, right?
Before you came here, all right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a meeting. Call it a meeting. Call it a gathering. Call it a church. Call it a schoolroom, whatever it is. But on the other side, another dimension, another place where there is no time and there is no space, you call it heaven, you can call it the cosmos, you can call it the ether, you can call it the astral world, whatever you call it.
Mm-hmm.
You're over there, and depending on your level of awareness, of your wakefulness, it depends on what level you're at. As it says in the Bible, there are seven heavens, and I'm sure there's that or more. Because Hitler wouldn't be going to the same level of astral world as Mahatma Gandhi, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Fish don't live on the land. They stay in the sea. Birds are in the sky, and we walk on the earth. So same thing when you leave. You don't become enlightened the day you die, and then you go and everybody is either in heaven or hell. That's an interesting concept, but that's not the kind of way I found it. And I've had several near-death experiences. So when we're on the other side, you're still in a school. You're still learning. But there's certain, like there's many things you cannot resolve on that side. For example, you can't learn lessons about greed and lust and gluttony and power and curing cancer and being pressed. All these desires that you have that want to be sex, all these things that can be filled through a sojourn in the human body. So you pull back in. You say, you know, I'm not volunteering, but you are. Just basically, if you have desires, good or the bad desires, or just desires, you got to come back.
Can you become a very high being and then say, well, I've never experienced gluttony and lust, so I'm going to go back in as a lower being? Can you do that? Is that what people do sometimes?
I don't want to say for certainty anything, but I think that once you reach a certain point, that's probably, if it's in the back of your mind as a desire, then as the Indians say, then go desire it, go do it and get it over with. That's
right.
One way to go. But to come back to Earth is not a great reward. As we know, this is a hard existence.
I know. Oh, believe me, I know.
Really, really hard. Even if you're the greatest optimist and enthusiastic person, even Mother Teresa was depressed. If you read her writing, she was very depressed.
Yeah, especially in her 60s, right, Bill?
Mother Teresa?
Yeah.
I'm talking about, I don't know what age she was when she died. I'm talking about the one that was in India helping all people. That Mother Teresa, the modern one.
Yeah, I know. She wrote about being depressed in her 60s,
yeah.
That it was really hard for her.
Oh, okay.
All
right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're talking about 1960s or age.
Mm-mm.
Especially where my mind is at. All right, but you're on the other side, and a group of your soul guides, guardian angels, gurus, teachers, higher helpers, any title you want to give them. Every culture has different titles. But they lead you, and they take a look at your karmic record, and they see what you need to, okay, you need to have this person back in your life, your mother, your father, your siblings, whatever, because you need to be around them to work out karma. Usually some of the toughest relationships that we have karma-wise are with those closest to us, relatives.
Relatives, yeah.
And so you're drawn to them, you're drawn to your parents and your family either through tremendous love or tremendous hate and anger and fear and loathing and all above, or other desires. So that's why there's so much conflict in families. And that's why they're there with you, so you can get to work it out. Hopefully people realize that their parents aren't evil and, you know, they're just doing their job. Everybody's doing their job. Get through it so you don't have to go through it again.
So, but when you say work it out, it doesn't mean actually resolve everything. It means neutralize your response, doesn't it?
Amen. Sounds like you're right on. That's exactly right. It's a lot of things you can't work out.
Mm-hmm.
You can work out for you, how you react, what your attitude is. But as far as other people going, you know, you can apologize for people, mistakes you made. You can make amends. You can do all this. But you can't change them, and you can't change what happened, you know, at some degree. But
you can accept it as something that you needed to have the experience of, right?
Yep. Yep.
Well, Bill, I want to go back to you being a little guy. Like when you were born and when you were small, you did not have an easy time of it. And so I wonder if you had an awareness when you were very young about the power of the soul and all of that, or when did that emerge in you? Did it take your near-death experiences, or weren't you already kind of aligned with this?
You know, it's interesting because I didn't know what I was doing, but now that I've learned different techniques, and I was shown a technique in the Himalayan mountains by a Tibetan master in 2004. And I'm going, and he didn't speak English. And he showed me this. I'm like, wait a minute. Actually, this is a three-year-old. Oh, there's actually a name for this thing. Oh, you actually do breathe in through the navel and up through the spine. And I go, oh, you know. So, yeah, I was meditating on my own at earliest recollections, and I was having experiences, and I was having visions. And then, you know, if you read my book, you know, as a warrior, a spiritual odyssey, the first couple of stories kind of deal with a couple of strange events, visitors, whether they're aliens or spiritual beings or what, I kind of leave it up in the air. But I had many, many such visitors and knowledge and things, and even ESP was imparted and increased and focused for me at a very young age. And then when I was 8 years old, I was extremely ill and was taken to the county hospital in San Jose. And I told my parents I was probably going to die. You know, it didn't look good. I had kidney disease. I had a lung disease. I had a bunch of other stuff going all at the same time. And I had a near-death experience in the hospital all alone in a room. And I had many of them. I was in the hospital for about a year. Now, you can picture an 8-9-year-old boy full of energy, all of a sudden on total bed rest. This would be torture for most kids nowadays. Total bed rest, no television, no radio, no record player, no books, no magazines, no coloring books, no toys, no newspapers, and most of the time, only one in the room. All you had was a staff coming in to do medical stuff and gone. So you can picture a year like that. For some people, that'd be like a year of solitary confinement. It would drive most people crazy.
That would be hell for some people, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It would be hell. Mm-hmm. I didn't fight it. I learned to withdraw from that now, that present situation, and was able to travel, to see things, to experience things, to have conversations with people, places, and events, and basically saw everything that was going to happen to me up to the age of 59.
Wow, really? Then what happened? 59.
Well, I was curious. Yeah, at 59, I go, what's going to happen then? I'll tell you the rest of the story there. But so I wasn't sure because I kept seeing when I'd be laying in bed, I'd see these two numbers floating around, 29, and then the two would flip over and look like a five, right? It'd go 29, 59. I go, what is that? But I was only given visions of experiences and things up till age 59. Now, 3 weeks before my 59th birthday, 5 weeks maybe, February, and this is my birthday is March 16th, so whatever that comes out. So it was February something, and in the year when I was 58, years old, and I'm going, well, I'm going to be 59 next year. Whoa. So I started thinking maybe I'm dying because I just had a major heart attack. And I went in and they did, you know, procedures on me. I had 8 stents put in.
Oh, wow. My gosh.
Yeah, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm older than growing as I'm laying there and to the doctor. And I'm saying, I go, what kind of deal is this? I'm vegetarian for 6 decades. I don't smoke. I don't do dope. I don't do drugs. I don't take sugar. I don't do salt. I don't eat white bread. I don't eat red meat.
You sound like a lot of fun, Bill.
Yeah, I have a lot of fun. And I meditate, and I live a clean life, and exercise, and do yoga. I said, well, look, you know, and all of a sudden now I got heart disease and diabetes and all this stuff. And he looks at me. I remember this 29-59, right? And he looks at me and he goes, well, Mr. McDonald, if you hadn't been living that such a clean life, you'd have been dead already at 29 with your genetics. Instead of turning close to 59 here coming up. And I'm going, 59, 29. Okay, so then I still had a concern about 59, but he just, out of the blue, he comes up with this 29. And I'm thinking, well, he's right, because when I get out of the hospital, at 9 years old, I changed my whole diet and my whole life and everything else. I mean, there was no booze. I was really a clean living person. And my friends all laughed from high school because they go, oh, you're such a poster child for living a good life. Look at you, you know, right? But I look good on the outside. That's all that counts. So I'll stand by that.
Yeah, but wait a sec. I want to ask you something before we leave some of this, which is that did you, like when you were little, were you one of those beings who already is kind of a high being? Is that why you had this, you know what I mean? Is that why you had this propensity for altered states and being beyond and so on? You're a trained soul.
It would take my perverted ego, which I probably have lots of, to say yes to that, but I won't.
But you know what I mean, Abby, because there is a sequence of learning that we do learn and we accrue sort of higher wisdom from our life experiences. So you must have already had a ton, right?
Well, yeah, something happened because I came into this thing, to be all honest with you. I'm doing yoga, 7, 8, 5. High school, I mean, I'm doing yoga. Everybody else is doing crazy stuff, right? I'm vegetarian. Everybody's doing their other stuff. I was a virgin in my 20s. I mean, I was clean cut like a monk. I mean, I was very saintly kind of life. And some of my friends in high school probably laughing because they know I was also a goof off. Class clown. But, I can't, somebody else would have to ask, I wouldn't even dare ask that, but I can tell you from my experiences, and you've read a few of them.
The book, incidentally, Warrior, A Spiritual Odyssey, is a real gripping recount, and we're going to get into that in a minute, yeah.
But I got to realize that growing up, I'm seeing the world through my eyes, and to me, being able to read minds, to know what's happening in the future, to move things with my mind, to heal animals and people and plants, to do little things like that, I accepted that everybody could do that. It wasn't until I started getting into high school and you start mentioning something and you realize that people are looking at you awful strange, like when I told everybody in high school that, you know, President Kennedy's going to get killed in Texas this coming week. And people look at you, I don't know, he's going to get shot. And then he gets shot, and then people look at you, and they go, how the hell did you know that? You know? So at that point, I'm realizing that maybe I should keep my mouth shut because not everybody's on the same understanding. Not everybody's on the same dimensional level. Not that I'm above or below anybody or anybody's above. There's no ranking on this thing. I really, truly believe that everybody is equally spiritual.
But I think people refine themselves by choice, and I think that works as a soul. And I want to jump you into the Vietnam War because with your history, you see, the question I always have, I think you've already answered, is like, who would go to war when they're awake spiritually? And then, of course, you go back to the Bhagavad Gita with Arjuna, who's going back to war, right?
Absolutely.
But some of your stories when you're in Vietnam are tremendous spiritual journeys, even though it wouldn't necessarily look that way, right?
No. In the essence of each of the experiences that I write about, and I try to write about things, and if you notice, I don't put a lot of personal emotion in things. And I'm a minimalist. I kind of get right to the point in the experience because I really want the reader to be the seeker, and I want the reader to go in without preconceived me telling them what to believe and think, and for me to interpret what happened.
Right.
I really want people to be able to connect all that. And you're one of those rare people out there, I think, is pretty much connected the dots. But everybody connects them at their level, which is all right.
Mm-hmm.
It's multi-leveled understanding.
Well, just for drama, if people want just the drama alone, it's just loaded with that. But the interpretations are vast, very vast.
But like, for example, let's talk about something because I was just dealing with the CIA issue today. I don't want to go into it, but just at one point I was an asset for Africa, which is another whole story. That's another whole radio show.
Let's do that.
About 3 or 4 years ago, I think I got this in my newest book. I was sitting around one day and I got a telephone call. It was from Langley, Virginia, from a contractor. And he identified himself. I don't remember what his name was or anything, but he had this document in front of him that he was reading, and it was on my one of my incidences in Vietnam that I thought the Army just pooped on, and it made fun of me because I was claiming, you know, something neat spiritual happened, you know, something mystical. And it turns out that there was a file on it, and there actually was research on it. And let me tell you what the incident was, and then I'll come back to this, what makes the phone call interesting. In Vietnam, I went out flying this one day, and I just got a new ceramic chest protector, something, a bulletproof vest, you want to call them, but you can have a bulletproof vest on, and you get hit with a round. It protects you a little. You still get the wind knocked out of you pretty darn good, and you're pretty bruised. Contrary to what they show on TV, the guy gets up, right? Anyway, so I just had a third date, and we're flying into an LZ, what they call a hot LZ, a landing zone. And there's 500 North Vietnamese troops that have come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And we're the only helicopter in the sky. And they all open up fire on us. Boom. It's like going into a shower and trying not to get wet. There's rounds coming all over the place. And I got orders not to fire back because there's friendlies on the ground. And inside my Huey helicopter was the commander, one of the ground commanders for the South Vietnamese Army guys down there, the Army Ranger unit. And unbeknownst to me and to all of my crew and to his people, the guy was a double agent. A lot of those guys, officers and enlisted people, you think they're working on one side, and then they're really infiltrated from the other side. So this guy was really on the other side. We didn't know that. So we land in the LZ really quick, like, he jumps off, and then he turns around just 10 feet away or so, and he has a clip of ammo, 18 rounds, in this automatic weapon, a BAR, I think it was. And he opens up directly on me. Just as I turn my head sideways to look at him, this blaze of light is coming towards me. And everything's in slow motion. I mean, slow motion, because for me, just to tell the story, it's 100 times slower than, or, you know, it happened just boom like that. So he opens up this clip of ammo, 18 rounds, and all of a sudden I feel this round hit me right in the heart. Directly in the heart, just centered right in the heart, right in my chest protector. Blows the ceramics up, and there's fire and smoke coming out of my chest. And I'm knocked back against the wall of the helicopter. And he just empties this loaded clip. And then we take off. And, of course, the helicopter's leaking oil and fuel, and it's smoking. And it's, I mean, we only go 100 yards or so, and we crash. And I get out, and I realize that I'm not dead, because I thought I was dead there for a minute. I mean, you look down your chest, you see smoke and fire, right? Mm-hmm. It feels like you got the wind knocked out of you. And anyway, so making a long story short, I pull the pilots out. I go to the other side, and on the other side of the helicopter, there's another door gunner. I'm sitting on the right side, he's sitting on the left side. We're back to back with a wall between us with a transmission. Now, on my side of the helicopter, there's no bullet entry holes where they got fired. There's just one round in my chest protector. But on the other side of the helicopter, where the other door gunner's sitting, there's 17 exit holes.
Wow.
And he's got round in his shoulder, his butt, his thigh, sides, you know, all his backsides all filled with shrapnel from the bullets.
Wow.
And so he's bleeding all over the place. So I throw him on my shoulders. I run across this jungle to get away from the helicopter. I didn't know what was going to happen. And then a rescue ship come in, and I throw him on it. And then the pilot, the commander, got on there. He was a major. And then they waved me and the captain off, the co-pilot. This was no more room. Couldn't take any more weight. I go, what? So they left us with 500 North Vietnamese troops on the ground, and they flew away. It's like, you're talking about feeling abandoned. It's like, whoa. So I go back to helicopter. I take off my machine gun. I put a 2,000-round belt of ammo clipped all together. In fact, they're all solid tracers. So I put them on the M60 machine gun, and I put it on my hip like John Wayne because I'm all hyped up now. And instead of waiting for the 500 North Vietnamese to come to me, I started walking towards where they're at. And I got the machine gun on my hip, and I just started firing from the hip. da-da-da-da-da-da, 750 rounds a minute.
Wow.
Okay, you can picture firing about 2 minutes and all of a sudden the gun goes click, because what most civilians don't know is every time a tracer comes out, it's supposed to be every fifth round. And an infantryman knows that you should let off the trigger. You fire bursts of five. Otherwise, you overheat the barrel. You go, you don't do this like in the movies like John Wayne and Rambo. You fire, if you fire at the whole time, you're going to melt the barrel. Well, I didn't know that. I watched the movies. I wasn't an infantryman. So this barrel, all of a sudden, it's red, white hot, and it bends. I got no weapon. I go, holy Toledo. So anyway, so make a long story short, we escaped and invaded the rest of the day. 8 hours later, we could pick up the junk. Long story, got put up for a Silver Star that day. Got wounded, got a Purple Heart, et cetera, et cetera. Ended up with a Distinguished Flying Cross. All right. So I go back and I tell them the story. Nobody wants to believe it. So they go back and they lift the old helicopter out of the jungle, and it's got holes where I said it was. And they send an investigation team out to look at it, and they see there's no exit holes. I mean, they see the exit holes, but there's no entry holes. They don't know how the bullets could have went up and around. But the only way that could have happened is if the 18 rounds, one of them hit me in the heart symbolically, and the rest of them just dissolved and somehow came out the other side. It was impossible.
Wow, it's magic.
So the Army made fun of me, in my opinion, and all that stuff, blah, blah, blah. And nobody could figure it out. And these guys took a bunch of pictures. They hung around a while, and then they left. That was 1967, so I didn't hear about them until 2013 or so, which is kind of odd, right? So
right.
Guy calls me up. He says, I got this file here, and on this incident, and he gives a date and everything. And I'm going, oh, April 14th, 1967. That was the day I shot down. He goes, yeah. I said, well, what do you got there? So I can't talk about it. It's top secret. I said, what do you mean top secret? It's me. It's my life. Well, I have to redact it to all you. I couldn't tell you all this stuff. I said, you can't tell me my own file?
Rules are rules.
Yeah, rules are rules. I said, okay, mine goes in there already. I wrote the book. All right, so I said, what do you mean? He says, well, the CIA has this. He was a contractor for the CIA, and he had like 8 or 12 million, I don't know whatever the figure was. It was a multi-million dollar budget. He was an engineer to design some kind of spherical armor that could then make the bullets go around.
Oh, wow.
And so he was calling me because they've been meeting on this thing. And this real conversation, I couldn't believe it. But it was like, I go, who's meeting? No, I can't tell you. That's classified. Okay. What did you guys discuss? Can't class. So we've come to the conclusion that you did something, or you know how to do something, and we want to know what it is. And you should give it to us as a good citizen and all that. And so me being pulled over for a free trip, and I said, I tell you what, you guys want to give me an airline ticket, I'll fly out there and discuss this with you. But in the bottom line is, unless you want to spend several lifetimes doing, you know, Kriya Yoga and meditating, I ain't going to be able to show you how to do this because you can't duplicate it. Oh, we'll find a way to duplicate this machine. I said, okay, good luck. So they didn't send me any airline tickets because they didn't think they were going to get anywhere if you teach them how to meditate. But what I find out is from other people, I have friends that were in the Psychic Warrior program.
Oh, wow. I remember that movie. Do you remember that?
Well, David Morehouse, well, the movie's got nothing to do with the reality. Stargate program was started at Stanford University.
Okay.
And the Army was involved in it. And it involves remote viewing.
Right.
And it was involved because, like all the good programs, the Russians were doing it. So we had, you know, there was a race between the Russians and us, right? So David Morehouse and other people got involved in that and they were actually having quite good successes, and then all of a sudden they got shut down because it was too voodoo for everybody. But that's a good book, by the way, Psychic Warrior by David Morehouse. Good book for somebody's interested in that area. And I just wrote the foreword for somebody else's book, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, and that book is out there. I wrote the foreword for him, John And anyway, that was
really well. Wait a minute. I have some memories of you. I mean, this is all pretty exciting because there's some credibility coming or some information, but also whilst you were in the middle of there are other stories in your book about being in the middle of battle that you turned around as well. Can you give us another one and keep it short so that I don't have to interrupt you? There was one I remember. I'm just trying to remember what it was. You did some praying, or you did some, not incantations, but something that you were saying that averted whatever the danger was at the time.
We had run out of fuel. We were flying over the jungle, and there was a fog down below. Just a fog just hanging over the tops of the trees, so you couldn't see the trees.
Right.
All just saw was low fog, so you didn't know where the openings in the trees were at. Now, the pilots I was flying with were so engaged in the mission, because I'm sitting in the back, I can't watch the gas gauge.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the gas gauge, when it gets down to, you're practically empty, it sends off an alarm. It's a horrible sound. This alarm goes off. This light flashes. It's bingo. We called it a bingo alarm. And it's the sound you don't want to hear. So all of a sudden, this alarm goes off, and these guys are flying around, and we don't even have any GPS coordinates or nothing. I mean, just like this old-fashioned navigation. We don't know where the good guys are at. We don't know where the bad guys are at. We don't even know where we're at, kind of. And now, and the pilots asked me, hey, Mac, because it was McDonald's, so it's Mac, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, Mac.
Big Mac.
How much time we got left? Is that 15 minutes, 20 minutes, or 10 minutes, or 5? When that comes, I said, I have never had one go on in my entire life. I said, all those answers could be true. We didn't know how much time we had before we ran out of fuel. And now, so we're up at about 400 feet, and we're thinking, any minute, literally, we're going to run out of fuel. Now, we could call in that we're going to crash, mayday, mayday. But we didn't know what grid coordinates to give anybody because we didn't know where we were at. We were flying around all day and we got disoriented, or the pilots did. And so I started doing my stuff, moving. See, in the book, I say I pray and all this stuff and the things, the fog parts. Basically, if you read the beginning of my book, where I talk about it as a child moving clouds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're the first to hear this.
Okay.
But the same energy to move the clouds as a child laying down, looking up, moving clouds and dissolving them is kind of what I focused on below.
Wow.
Now you're the first to hear that. That's the first time I've ever said this. I didn't put it in the book, but I figured since you're pushing me, I'll reveal something.
I'm pushing you, Bill.
Because I wrote it as very, it's prayer opened it up great. Well, it is prayer in a way. All right. So all of a sudden, we have an opening below us, but we don't know if it's good guys, bad guys, but we know there's no trees there. So we go right towards it. And just as we're landing, boom, hit the ground, the fuel quits. And all of a sudden the money just goes, poof, 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 poof. It's just run out of gas. And then we look around the tree line and we see all these soldiers coming at us.
Oh my gosh.
We're surrounded. And I'm along with a machine gun going, do I shoot? Don't I shoot? And then when they got out of the shades, out of the shaded area, out of the fog, because they're coming out of the fog, you realize. So when they start getting out in the open, I saw American uniforms. All the places we could have landed in that area, the zone that we were working in, and it was hundreds of square miles. This was the only place there was any troops. And it just so happened they had what they call a bladder, this big, like a big, huge inner tube type thing filled with jet fuel.
Oh my gosh.
Flown in by another helicopter. And so they had a pump, and we were able to fill up without telling people back in the company when we ran out of gas. So we saved ourselves the embarrassment. But so we were taken care of, we got gas, found out where we were at, we were back on track. But see, that's a little subtle thing, just a little subtle stuff. It's like we landed in in Tainan province, next to Tainan Mountain, which is Nui Bao Den, whatever the name of the mountain is, the Black Virgin Mountain. And down below that, we were doing some operations there. It was a little base camp set up, just had barbed wire out. That's the only protection we had was they rolled a bunch of barbed wire out to keep the bad guys out, and had this big open area and had tents and stuff there. So I landed in there to have lunch, take a break. And we're sitting in our helicopter, taking a break. And all of a sudden, we see this guy in black pajamas running across a few yards away, and he's running over towards one of these semi-trucks that's filled with artillery shells and ammunition. And he throws a satchel charge on it, and the thing blows up. And I don't know if you've ever seen the movies, but when you blow up an ammo dump or something, stuff gets red hot, and it goes off, but there's no specific direction it's aimed because it's random. It spins around, it jumps up in the air, it goes down, goes across the ground, can go straight up, can come straight down. You'll have bullets and artillery shells going off every single day. It's very dangerous. So we run to get away from it, and there's some foxholes. So me and my buddy jump into one foxhole, and there's some guys, put the guys in another foxhole a little distance away, and I get in the foxhole, and I go, this don't feel right. This is not right. Now, one of the rules of foxhole is once you're in a foxhole, stay there. Don't get up and go crawling or running across another one, because that defeats the whole purpose of being down low. It's unsafe. But I'm thinking, I got to get out of this hole. This hole's going to blow up. And I tell my partner, the other door gunner, I said, we got to get out of here. So I'm grabbing, he's fighting me. This is crazy, right? So I push him out of the hole, and I get out, and now he has no choice because I'm pushing him across to the other hole. We jump in the other hole, there's a bunch of other guys. And that's another rule you don't break. You don't put all the guys in one hole, right? In case something happens, you spread them out. So all those guys are yelling at me, what kind of crazy fool are you? My gunner's yelling at me, what kind of a crazy person are you? And then all of a sudden we hear this, boom, and this artillery shell goes off directly, not to the side of it, next to it, directly in the hole, the actual hole that we just left. And there was flames coming up out of it, and smoke and dirt was flying over us, everything.
Wow.
So you got to follow your instincts.
But wait, well, you have one more of those stories that I really loved, which is you were supposed to drop bombs or something on a group, and you kept saying, I can't do it. I can't shoot at those, whoever that is. Do you remember that one?
This is a story I just told 2 weeks ago to a group that was looking at the issue of moral injuries.
Right, okay.
Which deal with the ethics and your spiritual training and being an idiot, carry out orders and stuff. And so I give this an example that sometimes you don't follow every order you're given. You have to use something else. Sometimes you have to step outside of the box. And there's one of those cases where I had a West Point major just there from Germany, and didn't have any time in country, didn't know what he was doing. He was flying too high, but not low enough. In Vietnam, the safest place to fly, if you see in the movies, like Mel Gibson and all this stuff, they fly what they call the nap of the earth. They go right along treetops and down on the rivers and, you know, over the grass. Because you're low, you're fast, it's harder to shoot, you can't see it coming, it's safer. But new guys come over, they don't want to be down there facing the enemy eyeball. They want to be outside, you know, up high so they can see the terrain and they can navigate. But they say, oh, there's a mountain, there's a river, they can look on their maps. Well, I'm trying to explain this to the new major, and he's telling me that, hey, look, he's an officer, I'm an enlisted man, and there's no, you know, we're not going to do this talking between officer and enlisted man. I'm there to take orders. Okay, fine. Realize in a helicopter there's two officers and two enlisted men, so if you don't want to talk to the enlisted men, it's kind of a strange thing, right?
Right.
You're all in the boat together, so to speak, right? So we're flying over this area. I think it was the Iron Triangle or someplace. And it's where the Ho Chi Minh Trail drops into that part of Vietnam next to Pierre Peak. And he sees this group. It looked like 30 troops marching down a road in black pajamas with guns on their shoulders. And it looked like there was a guy in the front in black, some kind of black uniform or something, and he's carrying something. And for all practical purposes, it looked like 30-some men marching down the road. And so he tells me, he says, hey, we're in an area, it's called a free a free fire zone. You didn't have to call in to get permission to shoot at because there was a known man in the area. And he tells me to shoot. Now, I got an M60 machine gun. We just talked about this. And that fires 750 rounds a minute. And those are big rounds. And, you know, a couple minutes of firing at those guys, I could have tore them all up. There was no place to hide from me. I mean, it's a sitting target, shooting ducks in the water. So when he told me that, my hand didn't move. It's frozen. And my mind's going, no, no, that's not what you think. No, don't do it. So I told him, Major, I said, Major, that's not what you think it is. I'm not firing. So he gets mad. He tells me again, I'm giving you a direct order. I said, no, sir. He says, I'm giving you direct order in combat. Failure to follow my direct order. That's a court-martial offense. You're looking at 20 years in jail. I said, so be it. I'm not firing. So he asked the gunner on the other side, my little door gunner, been flying with me for about 6 months, told him to do the same thing. And to my surprise, and also a little to my concern, because I'm going on my feelings, he's only going on my feelings, he goes, I've flown with Mac long enough to know if he says something, I listen. If he says not to fire, I'm not firing.
Wow.
So then the major, that's real bravery. Think about that. I'm going with my, I know, right? So that's different. He's trusting me. So if I'm wrong, the major's telling me, you know, if you follow Mac on this, he says, you realize that's life in jail because two or more people disobeying an order is mutiny. And that's the highest offense you could get. Mutiny is either going to be a firing squad in Saigon or you're going to Leavenworth for life. That's what I was threatened with. That's what he was threatened with.
Were you scared, Bill?
No, not at all.
Okay.
That's weird. Somebody asked me that the other day. I've never been fearful. I don't know why. Weird. That's unusual. It's not normal. You should have been. Mm-hmm. Normal person. Maybe I'm crazy. Anyway, so he refuses to fire. So finally I tell him, I say, look, because he was trying to call an artillery and an airstrike on him. That's where you get the airstrike and the bombs. He was going to call in an airstrike on him, you know, drop napalm on him or something. Oh, my God. I said, tell you what, make a pass down there on my side. I got my machine gun. If they are what you think, I'll shoot them. So he does it reluctantly because he's kind of worried about getting shot himself, but he does. And we fly down near the road, and what it turns out to be is 30 children from the village with a Catholic priest carrying tools for the garden to go to the community garden to plant vegetables.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, I don't know what church you go to, but in my world, that's a pretty heavy sin. That's a lot of karma. Even though, this is what I try to tell people when I'm giving a class or a workshop on this ethical stuff to do and got that, even though I was threatened with ruining my life personally. I mean, let me say facts. 20 years in jail, life in jail, firing squad, those are serious consequences of disobeying an order.
Right.
This guy was serious. It would have happened. Okay? But I was willing to do that based on my feelings. How many people, and I did it with a group once and asked people to show hands, and now one hand went up. I asked people, how many people have the gumption and trust in their own intuition to bet it against life in jail or a firing squad when they can take no blame for doing it because they're following orders? The major would have been in trouble, not me, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how much even more guts do my door gunner have who had no faith other than me, faith in me, but he didn't know. My God, what a brave soul he was.
Are you still friends?
No. I wish I could. Yeah, real nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
It was an Italian guy from Nevada or someplace. I don't remember. Anyway, so the bottom line is, if you don't trust your feelings, and I mean trust them to that level, then they're useless to you. A lot of people, and you know because you're intuitive, and you meet other people and you know they're intuitive, but how many people actually trust their intuition to a level that, wow, yeah. So
That's huge. That's huge for me. And I'm pretty good with my intuition, but I question things all the time.
You got it for your own sanity. I mean, that's the logical thing would be, I try to tell other intuitives, no, you really, this is not a touchy-feely good thing. You really, no. Before you tell someone, you really, really, really got to know. It's not, I think, I feel it. You know.
Uh-huh.
How do I know? Because I could glimpse at the future.
Wow.
I know. That's it. So.
Well, hey, Bill, we're come running out of time, and I want people to know this is a brilliant book. I want to talk to you again. I want you to come back on, but I want you to tell people how they can find your book, how they can, explore the next book, and how they can take advantage of the very brilliant perception, spiritual comprehension that you have.
Okay. First off, if they go to Amazon, which is probably the easiest way for you to find the book.
Mm-hmm.
Type in Warrior, A Spiritual Odyssey.
Okay.
And I'll get my book. It has a beautiful cover of Machu Picchu on it, which is another whole story.
It's a beautiful book.
So that's Warrior, A Spiritual Odyssey on Amazon. Now, if they want to contact me, they can. Probably the easiest email address, I have about five of them, but the easiest email address, because they're listening to this thing, and I've been talking about Huey's, so my Huey number was 576. So I have a Gmail address that is Huey. 576@gmail.com.
What is it? Seely?
Huey. H-U-E-Y.
Okay. H-U-E-Y 576. Yeah. Okay.
@gmail.com.
Okay. Well, you're very, very interesting, but you take us through many, many levels. There's a lot of kind of like gestating awareness that comes from hearing your conversations, Bill.
Now you can see why when I give a workshop, I can't get them done in less than 7 or 8 hours. It's like, and then one question goes to that, another question goes to that. It's a never-ending topic. I could.
Well, when is your next workshop?
Okay, I got a talk in Marin. Actually, it's in the bottle, but it's Marin Unity Church.
Okay.
On the 5th of February.
Good.
At night, 10:30. And then I got Seattle, Washington, at the University of Washington, downtown Seattle, on the 13th. February. I'm flying up there to give a talk, and I'll advertise that on my timeline on Facebook if somebody wants to come to Facebook. Reverend Bill McDonald on Facebook.
And that's MC, not MAC, right?
MC, just like the hamburger. And then I'm giving a workshop for veterans and veteran families, so it's a veteran community thing for moral injuries, which I touched on a little bit here, but I'm doing that. And I'm doing that with Chief Sonny Reyna. I'm going to have him do a healing ceremony for these vets, which I think will be kind of nice. And then I got a workshop planned in Florida for veterans. I got a workshop planned in Florida for a group of yogis, Hamsa yogis.
Mm-hmm.
I got an open one for book signing. I'm working with the Catholic Diocese of St. Augustine for a camp I'm doing up there for mentally retarded adults that I did last year. I've been asked back. I'm working with the Coptic Christian Church, Egyptian Church. I hope to do something with them again. Mm. And last year I was there for the Buddhists. So I'm kind of a man of all. If you got a house of God, I'm there.
Well, listen, tell me this. When you're talking about, the moral injuries, does it really help people with PTSD? I bet you it does, to actually go through some of your healing with that subject.
Yeah, I have a separate workshop for just PTSD.
Great.
I'm finding that moral injuries is a bigger issue, and a lot of people that have PTSD also have the moral injury thing.
I would have thought that one comes from the other, actually, or the moral injury can create an incredible PTSD.
I'm finding that there's a lot of connections.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to disconnect it. And so people are raised, especially the people who are taking the military now, we're not taking in the scum of the world. The military's a pretty good group. I mean, you have to have morals. You can't have arrest records. I mean, you got to be clean-cut all-American Boy Scouts. Hmm. And Girl Scouts get in there now. So, and they've been raised with thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not this. So they go in there, and all of a sudden they face a situation where they got a 10-year-old kid has got a bomb that's going to blow them up, and they got to shoot a 10-year-old kid.
Ah.
That affects people. And so my job is to make them realize who they are, and forgive themselves, and to move forward, and that's another whole show.
Oh, this is wonderful. And I have to sign off right now. You've been listening to Reverend Bill McDonald, oh my gosh, I feel it's been such a privilege to talk with you. And this is Veronica Entwistle of Paradigm Shifters. So stay tuned for more interesting people coming up. You can tune in to my website, veronicaentwistle.com, and you'll be able to hear Bill and any other Paradigm Shifters podcasted on my site, on iTunes, on Stitcher, and on speakuptalkradio.com. Thank you for listening.